welcome to the Mile 99 interview series with your hosts, Greg Larkin, Mike Turner, and Jessica Harris. Enjoy this episode, and we'll hope to see you on the trails soon. Welcome, everybody. This is a special date and time for the Mile 99 interview series. We're joining you today on Sunday, October 4th, a little earlier than normal, and I'm really glad to see that everybody's joining us. It's our 15th episode, and tonight we're going to be talking to a New Hampshire-based ultra runner. Her name is Christina Fulcher, and just based on her time zone, we have things going a little earlier tonight. But we wanted to get her on the show. She's got an impressive resume, and we'll get into that in a minute. But first of all, I want to introduce my co-hosts, Mike Turner and Jessica Harris. How are you guys doing?
Doing good, doing good. Good to see you, Jessica and Greg. I'm a little tired from yesterday's long run, but recovering nicely.
Hey, guys. Doing pretty good. I'll be taking any questions throughout the show. Send them my way.
Yeah. And just, I want to just make one small announcement before we get into the show. People who have joined through Facebook, you may have seen that there's a content warning on tonight's show. And the reason for that is we will be talking at times about domestic abuse. So we just want to make our listeners and viewers aware of that. But we have a lot of other things that we are obviously going to talk about, but that will be part of the discussion. So just be aware of that, and some viewer and listener discretion is advised. So Mike, do you want to just kind of give everybody a little bit of an overview of what this show is about?
So yeah, Greg, we started this show, to keep our running community connected and inspired and motivated through sharing these great stories and inspirational things that achievements that different athletes have been doing, like Jessica said, she'll be taking care of the interactive portion tonight. She's tracking the chat room here in Zoom, noting questions. And then also we're streaming live on Facebook at the Aid Station Trails and L's Facebook page, which is a local running store. We're taking questions there through that live stream as well. Aid Station, the folks down there, it's an actual brick and mortar store in our town, Auburn, California. Great people. They're friends of ours. You stop by for a beer, some gear, and great conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. Really, really love that store. It's a big part of the Auburn trail running scene. And I know a lot of people like from out of town come by and seek it out when they visit the area and get some great trail running advice. So definitely recommended. So moving right along, tonight, our guest is Christina Fulcher, as I mentioned. She is based in New Hampshire. She is a trail runner. She's a race director. She's a coach. And she is a holder of multiple fastest known time records. These are called FKTs for anybody that may not be familiar, and we'll kind of get into what those are. And she's also a domestic abuse survivor. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. And we want to just make people aware of that. We want to hear what her story is, how she endured and how she got through it and emerged, and just find out more, about her in general and what her plans are going forward. So we really are pleased to have her on the show, and I am going to bring her into the session right now so we can meet her. Okay.
Are you going to unmute me?
Yes, I think we've got you unmuted now. Sorry. It always seems to take a little bit of time to get that
one. My other interview.
Great. Okay, so Christina, welcome to the show. Thank you very much for joining us. Thank you for taking the time. I know we had to do a little bit of wrangling time zone wise, but we're really pleased to have you tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Great. Well, one thing I also just want to say, and I see one of my other friends is on the line, Tim. I'm a New Hampshire guy. I grew up in New Hampshire. I've been out here in California for about 6 years. I'm really pleased to have you on the show. It's nice to have some representation. Hey, Tim, have some representation from the East Coast. We've been talking to West Coast people this whole time since May, so it's really exciting just to
talk to
some.
That's because I don't love the East Coast. Give us no love.
Yeah, there's that whole rivalry thing, right? Like, I don't know. I'm out here doing my thing, trying to fix it.
You better.
Yeah. All those rivalries. But yeah, it's really great to have you. So we, you know, we did a little bit of discussion before this session tonight, and we always send our guests a little questionnaire just so we can find out a little bit more about them. And so I just want to spend a few minutes kind of, you know, going through sort of like your earlier life, how you got into things. And I was pretty surprised to hear that you were somewhat of a donut eater till about age 19, huh?
I loved them. I'd sit down and watch Barney and eat a box of donuts. My little brother is 10 years younger than me, so he was at the perfect age for Barney, and I was at the perfect age for eating donuts.
So there wasn't, like, you know, some of the people we talked to, like, some of them come from like really active families, some come from not so active families, and they just sort of figure things out. So, like, you didn't necessarily have like role models essentially growing up, or just what was your, you know, kind of.
I found out that if you said you had your period, you could get out of gym class. I swear I had my period from like third grade on. If I could get out of exercise and if I was sweating, I'd be like, oh my gosh, I have a heat rash, and I wouldn't participate in field day. Like, I was so unathletic. I used to actually bring extra popsicle sticks to do the mile at school. You had to do 4 laps around the field. And I would hide in the woods, and I would have my 4 popsicle sticks, and I would cross after 20 minutes, my 20-minute mile. I was not athletic.
Learning all those strategies. Oh, yeah. So what was it then at that age then, like around 19? You got into some pretty heavy, stuff after that, like, you know, mountain biking and downhill racing and all that. Like, what prompted that?
I actually got sick of going to the mall. And one day a friend was like, we should try this mountain biking thing. I wore a pair of cutoff jean shorts, a white bodysuit, big hoop earrings. I did my hair. I refused to wear a helmet and bought $100 Huffy. I went in the woods. Oh my God. Don't ride in denim shorts. That was like, especially cutoffs. It was really painful. I think I crashed a bunch. My hair got ruined. An earring got stuck on a branch. Oh. It was a bad day, but I was intrigued by the sport. So I kept riding and eventually saved up and bought a bike for a couple $100 that was used. And I wanted to meet some people to ride bikes with. So the bike shop told me to go to a bicycle race. And I didn't know what the heck I was doing. But back then, women didn't race. There were 6 women. So I, you know, got to race against 6 women, and of course I got like dead last, but I was first in my age group. Of course, I was so psyched that I won a race, and, you know, just made a bunch of friends, and they kind of took me under their wing, and, you know, eventually I turned into a professional downhill racer. So the mountain biking was my first sport, but I had a broken back and dislocated shoulder and tons of injuries. So finally had to walk away from that one.
Wow. What year was that you were doing the downhill racing and all?
My last race was 2006. I think I started in around 2000, and okay. I had a bad accident after I turned pro, and my doctor had a long talk with me about being a vegetable for the rest of my life.
Mm. So,
sadly, I walked away from the sport and turned to high altitude mountaineering and dirt bike racing.
Which are generally safer, right?
Of course they are, unless you fall in a crevasse.
Do you find, Christina, that your ability to be high speed downhill, has that contributed to your racing? Because I noticed that people that are mountain bike riders, they're also good downhillers. The fear factor and picking lines at a fast rate, you find that may have helped you become like as fast as you are these days?
Yeah, so I'm pretty quick at running downhill, but I think a lot of it has to do with a combination of the dirt bike racing and the downhill racing, because you're just processing things so quickly. And when you're on a bike and you're going really fast, and I used to do a lot of technical stuff, you've got to read your lines and you have to kind of make a smooth path out of all the rocks. So there are a couple spots in the whites that are really chunky and weird, but I think that's why I like it here so much, is it's super rocky terrain. And that's what I started out on, was riding bikes on rocky terrain. It's more fun than your trails.
Yeah, you know, I did see that. What did I see? Like maybe about a month and a half ago, a little meme which had, you know, technical East Coast trail with all the rocks and the roots, and then technical West Coast trail with a nice bike path with a stick across it.
I raced out your way. I wanted to die. I ended up finishing Leona Divide with a 5-pound bag of ice, crying my eyes out. It was hot. There was too much running. I'm like, where's the walking?
Yeah.
This is not good.
No, I mean, honestly, we've talked to more than one runner out here that claimed they hate running.
Yeah, we're not runners here. We call it running.
Right. In fact, I think Mike may have uttered that yesterday on our long run. I don't like running. The Pacific Crest Trail is pretty runnable. And we were out there for a long time yesterday and we were not doing nearly enough hiking.
Yeah.
Plus the heat factor. I mean, you know, I grew up, as I said, like in New Hampshire. I remember the humidity, but I haven't been back in a while, especially this year. But here, you know, you've got the 100, 105 degree temperatures and all that. So it's just a different kind of scenario.
This year was epic with the humidity and the heat. It was insane. The tourists were like, they're pooping all over the trail. So you got to like dodge that stuff.
Yeah.
You know, so it's been a very interesting year up here. No rain. It's been some of the driest, except it rained during my 100 miler.
Ah,
of course, it had to rain during that day and it was nice and slippery, but.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Yeah, we're definitely going to get into that. Yeah, I mean, I was just talking to my dad today. He lives in Portsmouth and he was saying how dry it's been out there this year and wells are going dry and the whole thing. And then we've got the fires, so we're all enjoying the heat. Yeah, quite the year. Absolutely. So one thing I noticed that you also mentioned was you entered your first, I think, long trail race on a dare. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. So, well, my very first race, of course, I wanted to be cute. So I went to the running store and I bought a pair of running shoes that were too small. I literally had run 3 miles and I did a 16-mile trail race. It took me forever, but I finished the damn thing. My feet were bleeding. It was awful. And my friend was like, you need to do a 50 miler. And I was like, yeah, I'll go do a 50 miler. Well, I think I ran 25 miles the whole year. I mean, it wasn't much. And I did the Vermont 50. So that was my first one. And I'm a pretty stubborn girl. That's the only reason I finished. Like, it was hell. I think it was like 11 or 12 hours. I barely made it to the cutoff, but I finished. And that was my first 50. And every year I called it my annual stupid human feat. So I would do a long race. You know, then I stepped it up to 100K and then did 100 miler and then hired a coach and got a knack for running and found that I could actually do these things fairly fast.
Yeah. I mean, I was looking over your ultra sign up results. I mean, you've just been right up there at the top. I mean, you have so many top 10 finishes and, you know, on really difficult races, and all of that. And are there some of those that have stood out to you over the past decade or so?
Oh gosh. Superior Sawtooth was just absolutely amazing. I think that was, aesthetically one of the coolest courses I ever did. Pinote was probably my most fun 100, that I've done. One of the most fun races I've done. And I think it's because my friend Sue crewed me. And then my friend Sarah paced me, but Sue was great. She had like a full spread and pirate jokes for me. And she just made the whole thing really fun. She's been my best friend since we were like 20 years old. So it's definitely, it was cool to have her down there. It was cool to have Sarah, who was one of my La Sportiva teammates. And it was just a fun weekend. I got the meat sweats from eating so much meat. Actually, that trip was funny. I'm a US high pointer. Uh-huh. So I dragged Sue down to Florida. We flew into Pensacola and did the high point of Florida, which is like 384 feet. It's a toilet and a plaque. And we had a funny Facebook video. And then I thought that Pinote went over the high point of Alabama, but instead it didn't. So I finished the race like 7 hours faster than planned. So we had to drive north to go tag the high point, but I bought him breakfast. It was all good.
Now, because you mentioned the high point, have you done Denali?
Of course.
Yeah.
May 25th.
Very.
That was like the coolest trip of my life. I never wanted to leave the glacier.
Let's hear about that a little bit.
Let's hear about that. It was, oh my gosh, I trained for about 5 years to do it. Took a bunch of mountaineering courses. It was just epic. We got stuck at hike camp for almost a week. The weather came in and we literally had like one day to summit. And luckily the team was able to get up there and come back down. But it's just, it's beautiful. It's scary. Somebody actually fell backwards in the sled and died while we were there. You're digging out, you know, when it snows, you got to dig out the tent, you're building, you know, we were one of the first teams on it. So you have to build these snow walls and cut the blocks of snow. And it was some, everybody should do it. It was way too cool.
And then I flew in too,
like flying into the glacier. And I tried to get out of having to fly home, but they made me get on the plane eventually.
Then you land like right on the glacier.
Oh my God, it's so cool. So you're flying and there's like one shot pass. You've got a mountain peak here, and the planes go in between it. And then you land on the glacier. But the funny thing is when you leave, you have to stomp out the runway before the planes can come. So you're like, everyone's out there with snowshoes, stomping the runway out. And this thing, you get in the plane and they're yelling, we need this many pounds, and they're weighing everybody. So they throw you in the airplane and it's taking off downhill, but it's so darn bumpy that you want to throw up. And all of a sudden the plane just drops off the glacier and the pilots are awesome. All of a sudden you're back in the air and it's like the most beautiful flight in the world. It was such a fun trip.
Wow. What you said, but repeat, what year was that?
That was 2010, May 25th, we stood on top.
Oh, okay. Very cool. Very cool. Unreal.
I hated people when I came back, like the sounds of music and cash registers. I'm like, wow, our lives are so crazy. Mm-hmm. I'm living life again and I'm used to all the background noise, but it was awesome.
Wow. That is a really impressive trip.
20 pounds of crap. That's what you had to, that was the hardest part of the training, was hauling such a large load.
Oh yeah. And then how many days did you say it took to get up?
It was somewhere around 20.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, you're acclimating, you're like moving stuff back and forth. And then of course, weather windows, and it was weird. It only took a couple of days to get back down. It was pretty quick descending, but going up, you wanted to move slowly. So yeah. You didn't get.
So is that same type of like Everest effort where you're setting camps and moving up and down and all that?
Yeah. Yeah. So you'll like go haul some things up high just to get some acclimation. Then you come back down and you sleep low and you'll kind of keep doing that until you're acclimated. And then you eventually move camp all the way up.
So cool. Yeah. Do you get on any other mountaineering trips at this point?
Oh my gosh. Well, I was supposed to do the Torment Forbidden Traverse this year, but then COVID happened. I love mountaineering. And I think that's one of the cool things that trail running taught me, was to move a little bit quicker in the mountains. So kind of the goal next year, I'm getting back into rock climbing and ice climbing, is to go out and do some pretty big peaks.
Excellent. Yeah, we had a good interview recently with a runner out here who's also a mountaineer, and she just set the FKT on the what's called the Sierra High Route, which is down in, I think, the like southeastern Sierras or somewhere in that area, but like mostly off trail, 200 miles, I think it was.
Yeah, 200 miles. It's above the John Muir Trail along the Sierra Crest, and it.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe we'll see you out doing that at some point.
You know, I don't say never anymore. I used to say never. Right now, no.
Right. Cool. Well, so we talked, you know, you just mentioned the pandemic a little bit. And so let's fast forward, I guess, a little bit to this year and just, you know, the pandemic and everything that's been going on. And now you're a coach. You're also a race director. Yeah, like I'm assuming, I checked your race website, your race directing website. You obviously had to postpone and or cancel races. So you obviously had some impact this year.
Oh, it was huge. I couldn't really hold any of the races earlier in the year. And then the Forest Service gave me some permission to hold races later this year, but I didn't feel comfortable because of the amount of, and we had a discussion. There's been a lot of deaths and accidents up here this year. And I didn't want to cap out search and rescue. God forbid something happened during the race and we like needed a legit rescue. This year just wasn't the year to do it. So I have a virtual dog race that's a fundraiser for the Humane Society that I'm doing. But, you know, hoping to start up again next year with, you know, I do women's clinics, which the one I did last year was awesome, you know, and just get back into the mountains. And I'm hoping to add two more races to the schedule.
Yeah.
I think we'll see.
Yeah, no, that's good. Yeah, I mean, obviously, as we all know, a lot of stuff is on hold. And scattered races here and there, but very different than previously that we've known. So yeah, we're hoping, all of us, I think, fingers crossed for 2021.
Does this mean we're not going to be able to eat food from the aid station after people like touch their crotches and
yeah,
and shake it all over the food? We have to be sanitary now. What's going to happen to our-
this is not normal for trail runners, right?
You know. If you volunteered at an aid station, you know what I'm talking about.
Absolutely. I think actually the last volunteer, well, I did a volunteer right before everything shut down and I was at an aid station, but it was right before the lockdown. And even then, like, we had to have all the gloves. And so maybe all that stuff will that'll be a benefit of the future race scenarios.
I don't know. I think we should keep it nasty.
Should we keep it nasty?
You know, nasty conversations on the trail and nasty aid stations.
No doubt. It's going to be interesting for sure. So yeah, 2020, sorry to change the tone so suddenly, but obviously a difficult year for you. You know, in many ways professionally, and as we have, you know, talked about a little before this, personally as well, you had to exit a, abusive, marriage, and, you know, move into a new chapter of your life. And part of the way that you got through that, that we alluded to when we were introducing you before you came into the session, was through an incredibly challenging physical and mental undertaking. So I guess I'm trying to figure out how to sequence this correctly, but I just wanted to find out a little bit about like the exit process. I've read in a couple of articles and discussing things with you prior to this, that you had some assistance, you had a lot of support, people that were there for you when you needed it. And one of the organizations that you reached out to specifically was called Starting Point New Hampshire. It's an organization in New Hampshire that helps people who are in these situations of abusive relationships. And I just wanted to find out like what kind of resources they offered to you and what support and sort of how they got you and help you through this process.
Yeah, they're pretty amazing. So it started by a lot of my friends started marching out of my life because they couldn't handle watching what I was going through anymore. And one of my friends does a ton of work for Starting Point, and I never really knew much about them, but she was always encouraging me to call them. And I was embarrassed. And, you know, you feel like when you make the phone call, it's going to be, you know, public and everyone's going to know and, you know, you're a jerk. So finally, one day I was just crying my eyes out and I made a phone call and I talked to them for like 5 minutes and I hung up and I was just too freaked out. But it took 2 years for me to finally leave. You know, so I started calling them maybe once a month, and their counselors are fabulous. It's free. It's confidential. They give you advice. They're pretty blunt and honest, which I think sometimes I liked, and sometimes I got really upset at what they had to say because I'm like, no, it's going to be okay. But they really do know what they're talking about. And as things progressed and got more abusive, I started calling them more frequently. It was weekly, and they have counselors that'll talk to you in the middle of the night. You can call them 2 a.m. if you need to, and they'll call you right back. They have some pretty cool chat sessions that you can very safely and quickly leave. I'm not going to share all the tricks of the trade, but you know, if you're on a phone call with them and somebody walks in the house, they can quickly change the conversation to make it safe so that nobody knows what you're doing. They work with police. They will go to court for you. They'll do everything they can to get you safe. Depending on how unsafe you are, they can actually get you into a safe home. So there's a lot of options, but I think the most important thing is just make that first phone call, because it's pretty cool when you have somebody that doesn't know you that's listening to you and giving you advice, because they're giving you advice that's not biased by, you know, oh, well, I'm friends with both of you, or, you know, you're a really good friend of mine. And I think it's nice to have a neutral party to talk to whenever you need to talk to them.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, yeah, what a lifeline right there for sure. You said it took 2 years, you know, this is a long time. Can you just in broad terms for people that might be listening and don't really know, what are the different forms of abuse, you know, that that are out there, I guess, you know, different scale, I guess.
The two that people mostly think about are sexual and physical. You know, you picture the woman sitting there with a black eye, but emotional abuse, and a ton of women reached out to me after I went public, and a common trait is grabbers and yellers. So grabbers will grab you and stop you from leaving, and you end up with bruises on your arms. So it's not like, you know, they punch you in the face and it's like, oh my God, you just hit me. That's abuse. It's like, oh, well, you shouldn't have tried to run away from me. You know, that's why you have bruises on your arms. Or they'll make you feel stupid. Like, look how crazy you are. You know, so the emotional abuse, I think, is the one that needs to be brought more to light, because a lot of these abusers aren't like beating the crap out of women. I think eventually it gets to that point. You know, my experience was it started more abusive and became more physical. So I think the longer you stay, the worse it gets. But if you pick up on these emotional abuse signals, you know, start talking to people that are experts in the field, because you should probably leave. It's not going to get any better. And I think that was the hardest thing when I started working with Starting Point was the first phone call I made, he goes, it's not going to get better. It's only going to get worse. And it did. It progressively got worse.
And that's the first phone call. Like, you hear that truism, I guess, like the very first time you talk to them. Yeah. So, I mean, but even still, I guess it takes you time to kind of process that and like internalize it and make it real for yourself. Like, okay, like this person's telling me that, but I have to accept that and then make the decision to actually do something at some point.
Yeah. And then, you know, your abuser sitting there crying on the floor next to you. I didn't mean to do that. I'm so sorry. I feel terrible about the way I treat you. So then you feel like an ass for calling, and, you know, and then I wouldn't call for a month, but then there'd be another big issue and I'd call, and, you know, these issues became more frequent and finally got to the point where my safety was compromised and I had no choice. I had to leave and I had to work with the police. But, you know, my advice is to just make that first phone call and get out sooner than I did.
Mm-hmm. That's excellent advice. I appreciate you kind of detailing that for everybody, because it's like you said, I mean, it's uncomfortable for people to talk about. I mean, you know, I'm nervous. I'm just going to be honest with you right now. I'm nervous talking to you about this because it's a big issue. We have to face it. You know, and hopefully that, you know, once you start talking about it, you become, you know, able to, to just get it out there and let people know it's okay to make that call. And it's okay. You have to do those things. Because it's your, like you said, it's your safety.
It's your safety and it's your life. And I'm not going to say it's easy, because the first couple of months was hell. It was absolute hell after you leave. But then you start realizing that, and they set you up a therapist and everything. That's the beauty of it. Like, you have full on therapy for as long as you need it. And you start to realize that your life can be happy. It can be good. You know, but it's not going to be like, oh, look, you know, I'm out and I'm free and everything's wonderful. It's not.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. There's that period of time where you're just trying to live day to day, I'm imagining, right?
Yeah. I mean, I June 1st, I almost killed myself. You know, that was my plan, was to take my life. And, you know, I'm very lucky that I had a friend that had picked up on some things that I posted, and she called me all night long. And it was also the same night my dog had surgery and was supposed to die. And my plan was, when I got the phone call that he died, I was going to drink a 6-pack of Mike's, a bottle of Benadryl and a bottle of Unisom pills. And that was going to be my June 1st. And it was also the day that I had asked him to move out. And, you know, my dog lived. My friend called me. The vet called me every 4 hours for 3 days. He slept next to my dog. And, you know, I think it was just these little miracles and signs and people that cared, and friends that had left started coming back, and I started feeling happy and loved, but I was still lost. And that's kind of where this adventure, you know, led to, was I needed a reason to not end it all.
Yeah. Wow. Thank you for sharing that. I know I'm sure that's a hard thing to talk about, but thank you so much.
Sorry.
No, it's okay.
Let's get into your FKT, because it sounds like that you pull that strength and you pulled it together and you pushed it towards this adventure. Let's tell, tell us kind of how that all kind of came together.
I've always turned to like big adventures to heal me, and I needed something big, like really big. And I was looking at the 100-mile wilderness and, you know, some other known routes. And it was so funny. It was, you know, the universe has this really crazy way of making things click. Andrew Drummond, who is a phenomenal athlete up here, ended up going out to try this route that he had. It was the White Mountain 100. So I'm like, you know what? I want to do that. So I was excited following him, and he ended up with some wicked stomach issues and didn't finish. And I was like, you know what? That's what I'm going to do. So I told a couple of my friends, and of course I have my favorite non-believers, and they're like, there's no way you can do that. You're totally not trained. You haven't done anything longer than 25 miles in over a year. And I was like, no, I'm going to do this, and you know, I'm going to finish it. So I started studying all the maps and studying the route. And my friends, Jason and Leah, are absolutely phenomenal athletes. And they have, you know, FKTs for multi-day stuff. So I wanted them there with me at night because I figured I was going to be pretty beat by then. And as I started chatting with more friends, they kind of came out of the woodwork, and all of a sudden I had like a whole crew that wanted to help me, where at first it was going to be, you know, I was pondering doing it solo, but I'm a wimp at night. I didn't want to be in the woods alone. And then I had people with me every step of the way. I had people at every road crossing with good food and, you know, smiles. And it was pretty incredible how many people came out to help me. And I don't think I've ever felt more loved in my entire life.
That's so amazing. Yeah. I mean, I'm just thinking about that. Like, you know, when I've gone through hard times in my life, and just some of the people that show up at times that you don't even expect. And it seems like just kind of like a gift from the universe almost, you know, and you just never could have imagined, but they're there for you. And it sounds like that's what happened.
Oh, it was so cool. It was so cool how it all played out and came together. You know, I think that's a big thing I struggle with is asking for help.
Yes.
It was hard for me to ask so many people. And then I have a dog and it's like, who's going to watch my dog? And Rich and Ian offered, and my dog did the first and last part with me, which was really sweet too.
Beautiful. And you, so you were also using this as a fundraiser as well, right?
It wasn't going to be initially. I had many talks with my therapist because, you know, some of my friends knew I was being abused. Some of them didn't. Some of them left because I was being abused. And it's embarrassing to come forward. But her and I talked about journaling and healing. And she said, talk about it, you know. And I was like, well, what if I went public and turned it into a fundraiser? Because she had known about this epic adventure I was looking to do. And she goes, I think that would be wonderful. But you need to understand, some people are not going to be okay with it. And some people you thought were friends are going to leave your life because they're uncomfortable. They don't want to know you were abused. Some mutual friends are going to be confused. And, you know, she's like, you have to accept that some people are going to hate you and some people are going to love you and some people are going to be neutral. And I took a deep breath, thought about it for 3 nights. I actually wrote the post and the fundraiser and just had it on deck. And the night before I set out for the adventure, I figured, what the heck, I'm going for it. What have I got to lose at this point? I've lost enough this year. And, you know, I woke up in the morning and I didn't want to look at it. So I had the fundraiser going while I was doing it. And when I finished, I was shocked to find out I raised over $1,000 for a starting point, which was just phenomenal. That made me happy.
That's great. Yeah. It just kind of closes the circle. I would imagine like you got so much, you know, so much from them. It must feel really good to just get back in that way.
It was. And like more than that, dozens of women from around the country reached out to me. And sadly, several in my area reached out to me looking for advice. How the heck do I leave? And I mean, they're sending me pictures. And I mean, it was pretty heartbreaking. I'd gotten a bunch of those before I set out on my adventure. So, you know, I had little papers with me with notes and names, and you know, obviously it's anonymous who was reaching out to me, but mm-hmm. you know, just keeping people with me. And it's funny, but it seemed to give people hope that I was doing this 100. So there was no way I was dropping. I didn't care if it took me 2 or 3 days, like I was gonna finish.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, just the mental motivation. And you know, one of the things I well, I'm going to ask you now, I was planning to ask you, was just kind of like, what were you thinking about out there? And I'm guessing like about a lot of these people who reached out to you and what it meant.
Yeah, like I, you know, I'm just pulling strength from the fact that I didn't take my own life, strength from all these women that are suffering, strength from the stories of some women that reached out that there's people no longer with us because they didn't survive an abusive relationship. They never got out. So, you know, it was emotional and it was really cool because I had friends with me for different sections. So I had new energy and we got to talk about different stories and every single person that I was with, you know, did talk a little bit about, you know, what I was going through. And I think it was cool to have the new energy and, you know, kind of share stories with other people and have other people share stories with me.
Yeah. And just to talk, you know, not to derail things too much, but just talk about how difficult this undertaking is. I mean, this is a 104 mile segment of the Appalachian Trail. And for all of us West Coasters, this is not an easy trail, as we talked about earlier. Rocks, roots, you know, weather conditions, up and down the 4,000 footers. And again, West Coast people, 4,000 feet is no joke on the East Coast. So it's just talk about the
experience.
Sorry.
It's a full body experience.
Yeah.
I was so tired towards the end from, because you're lowering yourself and then it started raining and it was super slippery. And, you know, you actually go across some pretty epic traverses, like the Mariah, you know, Carter Wildcat Traverse. That's a hard traverse. That's harder than a Prezi traverse. So you do that thing and then you head out and you go across the Prezis. And I had actually never been on the Webster Cliff Trail. Oh my goodness, slippery, wet, steep. And like we were falling all over. And I had Tyler with me for that section. I had my dog Bennett and Rich, you know, with my dog as he and Ian were going to watch him. And then picked up Stas, or no, actually Jason and Leah for the night going through the Pemi. And that was actually slightly runnable. So I made up some time at night. But then there's this epic climb from hell coming out of the Pemi. And you go over Garfield and onto Lafayette, and I just drank a Red Bull. I put my head down and I said, guys, I'm not going to talk for a couple hours. So we didn't really talk until we got on the top and I was like, woo. Well, stupid me. I thought most of the climbing was done because once you get across Franconia Ridge and drop down, I was like, oh, the Kinsman Traverse. That's not that bad. I forgot about Wolf Mountain. And that's where I got my blisters and that's where the knees swelled and I got wicked chafing in my crotch and my butt and like, it was bad. And it was so funny because we finally got to the top of Wolf Mountain and I'm like, fuck you, Wolf Mountain. By the time I got to the parking lot, I literally had 10 miles. I just had to go up and over Moose Lock. And again, I wasn't quitting.
Yeah.
Funny. You know, people were waiting with sandwiches and French fries and like pizzas and all this good food. But the White Mountains are epic and it kind of linked together a bunch of epic traverses.
Absolutely. And I don't know if I mentioned it, but it's like over 34,000 feet of vertical that you're climbing throughout. I mean, for a 100 miler, that is a huge amount of climbing.
Well, yeah, 34,000 feet of climbing. I have no idea what the descending was. I'm assuming probably something similar.
Yeah.
My knees say it was something similar.
Oh yeah.
I don't think I had knees by the time I finished.
And like you said, I mean, all the rocky chutes and ascents and like you say, full body effort. I mean, it's not like just getting on a little path and running along. I mean, it's just not runnable, a lot of it.
Most of it was just fast hiking. And I was making good time until mile 80. And it was just the chafing, the blisters, the knees. I'm like, well, all right, I only have 20 to go, you know, but that's ultra running.
Yeah. No. Yeah. And then your total time for that, again, remind me of what?
It was 39 and a half. I was shooting for 36, but I definitely, once the blisters, I think that was the most painful thing was the blisters. You know, I was able to keep the chafing. I just like held my crotch and walked. I'm like, oh my gosh, oh my gosh. But the, your feet, you're kind of walking bow-legged and I'd try running and then they'd start popping. And I was like, totally not working out. I'm just going to walk.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And so just talk to us a little bit about you know, coming to that final mile or two and then meeting all your friends at the finish, and just what's going through your mind? What were the emotions like at that point?
It was absolutely amazing. So there was a friend waiting on the summit at Moose Lock, and then I'm coming down the trail, and I had one friend with me that went over, and I didn't expect my friend Carrie to be coming up. I hadn't seen her in years, and I was so psyched and ran into her. And then Rich came back with my dog, and unfortunately I finished too late for Jason and Leah. They had to leave, but it was so cool to see everybody. And, you know, we got to the last little bit, so it wasn't over as soon as I got off the mountain. We had like another, we wanted to make sure I got at least 100 in, and it was hard because there's four different maps we were using. So I figured if I went a little further, it was better. Of course, mile 99, my stupid GPS watch died. But I had the other tracker. And I mean, at that point, I'm like in the middle of the woods coming down the mountain. I obviously finished.
Yeah.
And we had a bunch of pictures. But it was just love. Like that's what I felt the whole time. I felt so much love for my friends and so much love from my friends, which was really nice.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it sounds like a cliche coming from me, but yeah, that's where you find out who's really there for you, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, my friends are just amazing. And, you know, even better, I wasn't even allowed to drive at the end. You know, my friend had a cabin, and she's like, go in the cabin, we'll cook you dinner, take a shower, here's some pajamas. And everybody took care of getting my car back. And, you know, they took time out of their life to do something really cool with me. And I think that's what made it so special was, you know, I've got the most amazing friends in the world. And if I walk away with anything from this whole situation, it's how important friendship is. You know, and it's wonderful.
Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about your family members as well? And kind of where were they throughout this whole thing? Oh,
yes. My mom and dad are so cute. I'm from Connecticut originally. So my mom and dad still live in Connecticut. They will tell you they took me on my very first hike. I don't remember, but it may have been. Growing up, my parents had us in the woods all the time. So that was our weekend thing, was going for walks in the woods. And my dad was always wicked funny because he'd make up stories like the Indians were here and this is where all the, you know, cowboys, and you're being a little kid, so you're just imagining all these things happening in the woods. Mount Monadnock was the first hike I remember as an adult doing with them.
Yeah.
They whooped me going up that, actually.
Oh yeah. I think it was one of my first ones too.
I was like, wow, you know, and I was in decent shape from the mountain biking, but I wasn't in hiking shape. And then things started changing. I became a better hiker, but you know, they're not super athletic, but they love hiking and getting out. I have a sister who lives in Connecticut, and she has a husband and two little boys, 3 and 6. They're wicked cute kids and funny. And of course, the 6-year-old likes to race me. And when he sees me, I always let him win. Well, one time I didn't, and he got mad. My brother and his wife have two little boys as well in Utah. And obviously, I don't get to see them as much. And right now, it's not happening anyways. But
yeah,
you know, I've got a good family.
That's great. And I mean, they must. Yeah, I mean, I can only imagine what was going through their mind as you were out on this journey. Yeah.
My mom was true. She had the tracker, and you know, it was so funny. I have all these text messages when I finished. I'm really scared for you. I'm like, Mom, I'll be fine. You know, they always worry. They never want to know who I'm done, what I did.
Yeah. But I mean, you've got the friends out there with you. I mean, you've got the safety factor from that, which is great. Yeah, we all, you know, a lot of any of the trail runners, ultra runners on the call obviously know how much it means to have a pacer, have somebody out there, like you said, that you can meet and kind of get that little boost of energy and that mental break and sort of like,
hey, when was the last time you drank? When was the last time you peed?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean,
you had to poop like 80 times the first, I don't even know. Everyone, I thought I only did it with the first person, but apparently I was like doing it the whole time. So, wow, you poop a lot. I'm like, I guess I do. I think Jason and Leah at one point were like, again? And I'm like, yup.
I might have a story from my TRT experience last year with my pacer, but we won't go into that.
Hey, the worst is when I accidentally wiped my butt with stinging nettles.
Bad idea. Let's compare and contrast to that and poison ivy, I guess. No, let's not.
Stinging nettles. I'd rather have poison ivy.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I mean, there's just the whole range of experiences and emotions on the trail. You never know. You never know what's going to come up. So unbelievable. So after that, I mean, you know, you finish, you know, you're back in that kind of the cocoon of the cabin, you're cleaned up. I'm guessing you feel good, like mentally happy to finish, obviously. What was it like after, like, say the following week of that? Like, did you have any lulls after that? Did you just feel like super empowered? Like, what was going on in the following days?
I felt really good. I had two moments, but you know, I think that's a part of it is I spent 10 years with somebody, you know, 10 years with somebody that I put 100% of myself into that relationship. I sacrificed, I tried, I wanted to make it work. Good or bad, it was still 10 years with somebody. So, you know, my therapist puts it perfectly. It's a grieving process. It's like a death, you know? So I think accepting that this is over, the police officer was doing a safety check on me and he was funny. He's like, go live your fucking life, you know, stop being sad. And I was like, oh, I can actually live my life now. And I think that was the big turning point with me was, you know, he was just like so blunt about it. And I redid the whole inside of the house. And, you know, I realized that I just want to be single for a while. I'm really enjoying time alone to reflect. You know, I think that the alone time has been really good for my soul, you know, and looking at myself and what I did. And I do feel very empowered. I'm very proud, proud to have been the first person to finish this darn thing. That was pretty darn good. And being a woman. Yeah.
I was going to, I'm sorry. I didn't mention that. I should have, instead of saying fastest known time, it's seriously, it's an only known time, right?
Yeah. You know, so I mean, I thought that was pretty wild and I've been in like a ridiculously good place lately, which is nice. I still have healing left to do, but. Well,
yeah. And I mean, I got to say, like, let's just reiterate. I mean, this did not happen that long ago. I mean, this was 2020 that this really started happening. And I mean, you know, got out of the relationship. You did the run in August. This was late August. So it's only been like 6 weeks since that happened. Yeah. I mean, it's going to take time, obviously. How do you feel? Like how is it, like, do you feel like it's progressing the way you want to, like the healing process?
Yeah, life has been so beautiful. It's been really cool. I'm reconnecting with all my old friends, which is awesome. I've been spending more time in the mountains than I think I ever have, which has been really nice. You know, I've got a perfect job. I love what I do. I'm excited about filling out permits for doing races next year. And, you know, made a lot of mistakes on the farm this year, but I'm learning how to do it on my own. Next year will be a lot better.
Yeah.
So it was untangling goats from the electric fence. That was quite the adventure. They're going to freezer camp soon. I'm sorry, vegans. And the chicken slaughter Sunday.
All right. Well, talk a little bit about where you live. I mean, I know you live in Tamworth, New Hampshire. I'm familiar with it. I've been up there, you know, when I used to live in New Hampshire. Absolutely beautiful country. I mean, the foliage is popping right now.
It's over. The leaves are
past peak, maybe. Yeah. But just beautiful area. Like, just give us a little visual picture of like where you live and what it's like there.
Heaven. I take a picture every day of the mountain. I can see Mount Chicora. I live by Mount Chicora. It's the most beautiful place in the world. You know, I live in the middle of the woods. I've got moose that come in my yard. I have a bear that kept trying to break into the house in the car. So he's a problem. But aside from that, you know, trails all over the place to run, snowmobile trails that get groomed. You know, it's just like the perfect place to train and live. And I have a small farm. I've got goats, chickens, a greenhouse, and, you know, kind of learning how to do that on my own is new, but I'll be better next year.
I mean, for me, like any type of growth that I can foster, like whether it's a garden or anything else or build something, like that's a healing process. That's empowerment. Like, I'm guessing it's similar for you.
It is awesome. to just, like, you know, be like, I planted this and it grew, or, you know, even the farm animals, it's really cool to raise animals and experience, you know, what it's like to have one. I'm learning how to hunt. That's been a definitely a new adventure. My friend Carrie and I went out and she shot a bear, and it was like an interesting experience to clean that and actually learn how to track it. And I'm hoping to go out and get a deer this year. So definitely taking on a lot of new adventures, but trying to learn how to be self-sufficient.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's, I got to say, it's the New Hampshire way, right?
The woods, you know, going hunting. How cool is that?
Right.
You know, it's awesome.
Yeah. And just, yeah, like getting that power for yourself. I mean, I have to imagine it's such a good feeling.
It is.
We had hunting season opened up here in California. So I've been out, we've been out running. And it's like, you know, I should be wearing orange because I came across hunters the other day in this really obscure canyon. I popped out of this canyon. It's not even a trail. And I was like, these guys with guns everywhere. I'm like, I should probably be wearing some orange hat or something, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's, you know, you definitely got to make sure you're seen, and I'm learning the ropes. I'm very new. I have my apprentice permit for hunting and just got my first gun and learned how to shoot it. And boy, I screamed like a girl. I was like, woo! So she's been working on that and, you know, teaching me how to do it in a safely, kindly. You know, my friend's pretty interesting. You know, we sat down with the animal and they said a little prayer before we hauled it out of the woods. And holy cow, that's a workout. I don't know if you've ever hauled something. You know, I just imagine you're hauling the animal on a sled down a trail. You're not doing that. You're hauling it over sticks and rocks and bumps, and there is no trail. So that was interesting.
No doubt. Can you talk a little bit about your future and what other types of things you see yourself getting into in the next year? Like, are you planning on more FKT attempts? Or are you just mostly working on the farm? Like, your business, your race business will start up again at some point. Like, where do you see yourself?
Living, enjoying, definitely combining my love of mountaineering. I definitely want to do some high alpine routes. I want to pick up a few more high points next year. There's a couple of FKTs I'm looking at, but my body seems to like the long distance stuff. I'm kind of hoping my little thing gets me into Barkley next year. That has been something that's been eating away at me for years. And if Laz will let me in, I'm going to be the first woman to finish that damn thing. New Hampshire girls are tough.
Right on.
And I'm going to do a figure competition because I was actually training for one of those bodybuilding competitions last year. And my show got canceled 3 days before my show. So I never got to stand on the stage and strut my stuff in that stupid little bikini. So I definitely want to do that at some point next year. I do it all.
Yeah.
And of course, hosting races and
right,
putting on the hardest 50 in the country. We'll see.
Yeah. I mean, tell us when that is, because, you know, we got to come out and represent the West Coast. with our non-technical bike paths and all that.
Now.
Yeah. Oh, so great. Well, I know that, you know, we're coming towards the end of the hour here. I think we've touched on some really just excellent topics, and I really appreciate your openness and just willingness to sit with us and talk about a lot of things. We have some audience questions. So we'd like to move into that section of the interview right now.
Hello, hello. So I got an anonymous question from Facebook Live. And the question is, did any of your friends who left during your abusive marriage come back? And has there been any reconciliation?
Every single friend that left came back, including the one he threatened to hurt. I was shocked that they all came back. I've not lost one friend.
Ooh, that gave me chills.
Yeah. So that was awesome.
Yeah, because I could imagine there might be some fear that making such a big change in your life might burn some bridges, some good, some bad, and part of the process as well.
I like how you mentioned, Christina, how it's everybody handles it differently. Some people are uncomfortable with it, some of your friends. So it's almost like giving your friends space to, I know it's a minor issue, but deal with it and they'll come back or they won't. But everybody handles it
they need to heal. They, you know, there's like three levels of friends. You have your Facebook friends, which are people that see the pretty cute version. You have your acquaintances, which kind of sort of know you. And then you have your good friends that know all the dirt, because you kind of put on your, you know, show face for the friends that you only see once in a while. And those are the people that had a harder time, and they distance themselves. You know, it's not that they completely hate you or walk out of their life, but they need to process it. And then you have mutual friends, and that's really hard for mutual friends that didn't know what was going on to be like, what the heck, you know, how did I not know this was happening? So, you know, and it's just allowing people to do what they're comfortable with. If they're not comfortable being around me, then I'm okay with that. You know, I have a lot of people in my life that make me happy, and I welcome anyone in or out of my life as they feel comfortable.
And it sounds like, I mean, you're at this point able to just live your authentic self. You know, that's the real person, right?
Oh, that's the real person. It's scary, but it's real.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that's what, you know, like as I've aged in my life, I mean, just realizing like that's your highest form of expression is living your authentic self.
Yeah. Like, I don't want to be somebody else. I don't want to walk on eggshells. I don't want to be fake. Like, I just want to be silly, goofy me. And if you don't like it, then that's okay. You don't have to like me. You know, we all can't like each other.
Right.
It's been nice to finally be me.
Yeah. No, it sounds like the process, while painful, has just really been working for you. And we're really happy to, you know, hear all the accomplishments and the achievements that you've undertaken and gotten through this year. It's just great.
Thank you.
I think Jessica?
I just thought that I would mention, for anyone who's in Placer County who might be in a place who needs the resources, Stand Up Placer and the Lazarus Project are places that you can go for help, for counseling or for resources, and even for housing.
Excellent. Thanks so much for mentioning that.
And Jessica, I think we mentioned some of the neighboring counties. What is that one in Sacramento, WEAVE? What is that acronym?
Women...
Escaping abusive and violent environments, I believe.
Environments. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so every county has an option. So find them; they can be found easily.
Excellent. Are there any other words of wisdom that you could offer people out there, Christina, that might be struggling right now? Anything that you know you needed at a certain time that you could tell them?
Hold on to your friends. You know, they oftentimes, your friends know you a little bit better than you might know yourself, and always choose happiness. I think that's the biggest lesson I've learned, is if it doesn't feel right, it's probably not right. You shouldn't have to apologize for who you are, and you should just try to live your life and be yourself.
Perfect. I think that's just a perfect way to wrap up everything right here. So thank you so much again. I just want to, thank everyone that came on, the questions that we got, and everybody for listening to Christina's amazing story here. We're going to post this as a podcast, as we often do, or as we always do at this point. We have the option of adding all kinds of notes to the podcast episode. So we'll certainly add links to all these resources that we've mentioned and anything else that we can find that we think will be helpful. So look for that in the next couple of days. And with that, I just want to thank everyone for coming on at a different time for us on the West Coast, but we really appreciate it. And Christina, if you can just stay on the Zoom session, we'll shut everything down now. And thanks again, everybody. We'll see you again for another episode of the Mile 99 interview series. Take care. Good night.